This is August 16th, 2015, and we're just 4 days away from the birthday of our founder, Roshi Philip Kaplow, and so today is our Founder's Day. I'm going to comment on a koan in the Mumonkan. It's was one of Roshi Kaplow's favorite koans, number 31. Joshu investigates the old woman. And here's the case. Each one of these koans has a case, a commentary, and a verse. The commentary and verse were added by Zen Master Mumon, or Woman. He's Chinese. Joshu, of course, is also Chinese. His Chinese name was Zhao Zhou. Maybe I should switch to the Chinese instead of saying Joshu. So here's the case. A monk asks an old woman, "What is the way to Wu Tai Shan?" The old woman said, "Go straight on." After the monk had taken a few steps, she said, "A good, respectable monk, but he too goes off like that." Later, a monk told Zhao Zhou about this, and Zhao Zhou said, "Wait a bit. I'll go and investigate that old woman for you." The next day, off he went and asked her the same question and got the same reply. On returning, Zhao Zhou announced to his assembly of monks, "I have investigated and seen through the old woman of Wu Tai Shan for you." I'm going to forego reading biographical material about Zhao Zhou for the few of you who may not already know. He was one of the greatest of the great Chinese Zen masters from the Tang Dynasty of China. He lived in something like the 700s and 800s in China. He appears in more koans than any other master. Now, our wording, which is common among the different translations of this koan, say a monk asked an old woman. But another translation says, whenever a monk asked this old woman, "What is the way to Wu Tai Shan?" So I think the koan makes more sense if we understand it as a pattern on her, a pattern of response on her part. This goes straight on. To a number of monks who came along. But first, the question, what is the way to Wu Tai Shan? Or in Japanese, Mount Gotai. Shan means mountain. So Wu Tai Shan in Chinese, Mount Gotai in the Japanized version. Wu Tai Shan was considered the abode of the Bodhisattva Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of wisdom. A Bodhisattva is an archetype of qualities, capacities, maybe, that we ourselves have, that we all have in common. We all have this innate wisdom, this boundless wisdom. The same with compassion and other fundamental qualities of our true nature. And someone a long time ago came up with a way of referring to these as bodhisattvas, the bodhisattva of wisdom, the bodhisattva of compassion, just Kanon, Guanyin, Avalokiteshvara. I think there is real understanding of human nature behind making these qualities, to personifying these qualities as bodhisattvas. It makes us better able to relate to them, or some people. It helps some people relate to them. Otherwise, these can so easily become abstract ideas: compassion, wisdom, action, and so forth. And so, Manjushri, as the bodhisattva of wisdom, begs the question, what does wisdom mean? The answer is that in Buddhism, not just Zen, but Buddhism generally, the wisdom is the essence of our nature. And what is that essence? The Sanskrit word is shunyata, emptiness, no thingness. That what is common to all beings and all things, all creatures, all objects, all phenomena are, in their essence, nothing. All things are nothing, fundamentally, essentially. Contrary to the appearances of things, it takes awakening, what the Japanese refer to as kensho, it takes kensho to really confirm this through one's own experience, not just as an idea that makes sense maybe in a certain kind of way, or maybe makes no sense to think of all things as nothing, in their essence, having no abiding substance to them. But this is the nature of all beings, all things, devoid of any permanent, fixed self-nature. Self. Now, this was a time in the during the Tang Dynasty where we hear that many thousands of monks would set off on pilgrimages with the delusion that they would find wisdom somewhere outside themselves. And probably the number one place in Tang Dynasty China where you would want to venture to with the idea of experiencing wisdom is this Wutaishan, the center. It was sort of the navel of Buddhism in China. It wasn't just one mountain. I learned this on one of my pilgrimages to China. We went to Wutaishan and understood the name. Wutai means five terrace. And what we discovered was that it's a cluster of mountains that are referred to as Wutaishan. At one time, we learned when we were there, in ancient times, there were 800 Buddhist temples on so-called Wutaishan. And then, during the Cultural Revolution, when the Red Guards under Mao went rampaging through the country to destroy just about everything of China's culture, ancient culture. It was reduced to 49 temples out of 800. And then, even when I was there 30 years ago, the government was already starting to rebuild some of the temples. They saw in Wu Tai Shan a great source of tourist revenue, and so I don't know where things stand now, but I would bet that they've rebuilt a lot of those temples in order to draw more tourists there. But in Zhao Zhou's day, this was sort of the center of the universe in China, and any monk would see this as a very exalted trip to be able to go to Wu Tai Shan, maybe with the hopes that there at Wu Tai Shan they might come to enlightenment. Now, apparently, this old woman had set up her station of some kind there on the road, and when the monks would ask, "What is the way?" her response was, "Go straight on." Another translation is, "Go straight ahead." And that's the first point of the koan. What is she really saying? There is a wonderful story that Shibayama Roshi relates in his comments on the Mumonkan about a freighter, a huge ship on the Amazon. The Amazon is so huge, so wide, that you can be, if you're in the middle of the Amazon, you won't be able to see the banks on either side. And this freighter had found its way up the Amazon and still thought they were in the ocean. They had run out of water, fresh water to drink. And they were growing alarmed at being out of fresh water. And so they called out to another ship, could you spare some drinking water for us? They couldn't drink the salt water that they thought of the ocean that they thought they were on. And the response from the other ship was, "Lower your buckets. It's right beneath your feet. All the fresh water you want." After the monk had taken a few steps, she said, "A good, respectable monk, but he too goes off like that." Here too, what is she saying? What does she see in this monk and the other ordinary monks who come toddling down the road? I acquired a greater appreciation of her response after having been there to Wu Tai Shan, because the road to Wu Tai Shan, literally the dirt road, is a wildly curvy road. The closest we could get by train was, I forget now, at least 4 hours from Wu Tai Shan. And then after deboarding the train, we had to take a bus those last 4 hours along a road that was just amazingly curvy. The only curvier road I've ever been on was the road from Oaxaca to the Pacific coast, Puerto Escondido, Puerto Angel. Serpentine, endlessly curving. And she says, go straight on. Lower your buckets. Then it says, later a monk told Joshu about this, and Joshu said, wait a bit, I'll go and investigate that old woman for you. Part of what koans offer is a method by which we can develop our intuition, because koans provide just the bones of a dialogue or a story. They aren't novels. They aren't even short stories. They don't color in the personalities and characters of these different characters, much less tell us how experienced they are in Zen. And then it becomes the challenge of the student to see through the words of the koan to the spirit behind them, the utterances of the different characters, what's behind them? What is the personality or the character? In what way are these different characters asking their questions or making their statements? So already, the student would have to try to get a bead on this old woman and understand somewhat where she's coming from, what her experience is as a Zen practitioner. Is she long experienced? If so, has she had any insight into her true nature? I think we can imagine, and that's part of what koan work is imagining, speculating, that since this was a pattern of her responding in these same words over the course of, who knows, weeks, maybe months, to many monks as they came down that road, that it would become a topic of conversation, gossip, at Zhao Zhou's temple. Drawing from my own imagination, I would see these clusters of monks in this giant monastery of Jiaozhou, where there were hundreds of monks. I think I read as many as 1,500 at one point. And without radio or TV or computers or internet or Facebook or texting or so et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, things would get slow at times around this monastery. And I could imagine groups of monks chattering away. Did she? She said that to me too. Yeah. And you too? Yeah. What? Whoa. Who is this woman anyway? What's she got? Is she just posing? Is she just playing Zen? And to stretch the imagination a little more, I see Jiaozhou coming around the corner and encountering this group of monks chattering away about this woman, and then them all clamming up. Stop. Here he is. Here's the master. Look serious. Have your eyes down. We're doing our moving Zen. And I could imagine him immediately getting wind of all of this back and forth, this gossip about this old woman. And he sees that this is not what he wants them to be doing. This takes them away from the Zendo. It's just kind of a form of entertainment for them. And so in response he says, wait, I'll go investigate that old woman for you. Don't worry. I'll let you know what's going on with that old woman. I'm going to reminisce just now and then about Roshi Kaplo. I remember in the mid-60s when everyone was talking about Carlos Castaneda's books, The Teachings of Don Juan and a couple of others. And he finally gave a teisho on this supposed Don Juan in the Mexican desert, this great sorcerer or wise man. There had been so much speculation about Don Juan. And I don't remember so much about what he said, except this. He said, this is not a real person. This was a creation of Carlos Castaneda, the author. Carlos Castaneda, before writing this series of books about Don Juan, had taught creative writing. And once he said it, then it was so obvious. Of course. Has anyone ever found Don Juan? It would be very strange when half of the hippies in the mid-60s would have wanted to find him. And then, as I remember it, all the talk about Don Juan and his supposed powers stopped. And then the case goes on. The next day, off he went, Jiaozhou. He found this woman and asked her the same question, what is the way to Wu Tai Shan? And got the same reply. Yet another point of this koan. How did he ask her the question? With what words and in what spirit? How did she reply? In what spirit? And then apparently he just went back up to the monastery. He gathered the monks together and he announced to them, "I have investigated and seen through the old woman of Wu Taishan for you." Period. Nothing more than that. Nothing more that we're given, nothing more that has come down to us over the last 1,000 years. "I have investigated and seen through the old woman for you." I love that, "for you." Okay, it's done now. As if someone can see into the nature of, the fundamental nature of anyone or anything for someone else. The monks, no doubt, were eager. No one missed that assembly, having heard that he was going to announce his impressions of this old woman. And what does he give them? "I've seen through the old woman for you." That's it. Where does that leave them? The word kensho literally means to see things as they are, or sometimes to see the true nature of things. We can be sure, since Zhao Zhou is considered one of the several most illustrious of all the Chinese masters, that he had indeed had kensho and deepened that initial kensho experience that he'd had under Nanxuan, Nansen, in the many years of practice. We're told that he had his first kensho at the age of 18 under Nanxuan, and then full enlightenment at the age of 56, and then he went on pilgrimages for another 24 years and only began teaching at the age of 80. You don't need kensho to have, in some sense, seen through the world in a way. When I was new to Zen, I had just arrived in Rochester and was trying to get a handle on the Sangha, all these people I'd never met, what brought them there. And I asked one of my sisters, I had two sisters who preceded me here, I asked them, "What do you think it is that, is there some common denominator, something in that all people at the Zen Center have in common?" And I said, "I think it's such and such." I don't remember. It wasn't so profound. And then one of my sisters said, "I think that everyone who comes here has seen through something." After World War II, Philip Kaplow had seen through something. He had seen through the conventional way of understanding reality. He hadn't realized what was beyond that, but he was desperate to find out what else there was. His karma led him to D.T. Suzuki at Columbia University, and he learned more and more about Zen, the philosophy of Zen, before he realized that he needed to step it up and actually do the practice. He needed to go back to Japan. I shouldn't say do the practice, because what I heard was that when he went back to Japan 4 years after the war to train in Zen, no, when he went back to Japan after 4 years after the war, he didn't know that he had to sit. It's stunning to imagine this, but with all of those courses he took with D.T. Suzuki, he apparently had never heard that you need to sit. He said that he imagined somehow that if you just sat down and sipped tea with the Roshi, or sake with the Roshi, you would somehow absorb by osmosis this thing called enlightenment he'd heard so much about from D.T. Suzuki. Imagine the shock of getting there and being told to sit, go sit. It was terribly painful for him in the early stages of practice. He said he had not led a very upstanding life, and as he said it, quoting a writer, I think maybe D.H. Lawrence, but he had been engaged in the endless pursuit of pleasure. And then he had to cross his legs and sit without moving. And it was a grueling experience for him. There were no chairs. There were no benches. There was a single zafu, single round cushion that you're provided with. And he found that he couldn't sit in any of the cross-legged or other, he couldn't sit on the mat and sit still. And so Harada Roshi found a farmer in the district who had a chair. It's hard to imagine, but this was kind of a really novel object for anyone in Japan to have at the time, a chair. At that time, at least, it was standard to just sit on the floor with your legs tucked underneath you. But this farmer had come upon this chair, and Harada Roshi used his influence to have the farmer lend this chair to Kaplo-san, and that enabled him to make this grueling transition a little less so. And he was able to stay at Hoshinji, it's Hoshin Monastery in Obama, and put in a good 3 years at Hoshinji of Sesshins. I don't know at what point he tossed away the chair, but by the time I got here in 1970, he was sitting full lotus all the time, whenever he sat. Just gives us an understanding of his grit, his determination, and his need to see through the world as he had known it, to see through the mind as he had understood it, to see into what is beyond our ordinary way of apprehending reality through the five senses, and the sixth one being thought. And this says so much about anyone who comes to Zen, and certainly at least anyone who sticks with it for a while through the difficult opening stage of practice is what, whether they know it or not, and I think most of us don't know it, haven't articulated it this way, we want to see through our ordinary way of understanding reality, understanding people. And we have seen through it. Yeah, we have seen through it enough to aspire to something beyond what we can know with our ordinary mind. If we hadn't seen through ordinary perception to some degree, we wouldn't even imagine that there was any other way, there was any other realm or dimension of perception or understanding. And this koan is a classic koan. It's what the Japanese call a nanto koan, which just means an especially thorny, difficult koan. But like any other koan, it presents this thicket of words and little more that we have to intuit our way through and beyond to see what fundamental truth it's pointing to. Roshi Kaplow always used to say, every koan in its own unique way is pointing to our true nature. This old woman was pointing to our true nature. Zhao Zhou, when he said, I've seen through the old woman for you, was pointing to our true nature. Pointing the monks to Wu Tai Shan. Go on to the commentary, Zen Master Mumon's commentary. The old woman knew how to sit still and plot strategy, yet she is not aware of the bandit stealing into the tent. Old Zhao Zhou was clever enough to creep into the enemy's camp and menace a fortress, but he wasn't a great commander. Upon close examination, they both have their faults. Tell me now, what was Zhao Zhou's insight into the old woman? Well, Wu Men seems to be letting us know that the old woman missed the real understanding of Zhao Zhou. And there's nothing to suggest that he let on who he was or the depth of his understanding. I found a quote by Bernard Malamud, an American novelist who died in 1986. Just this line makes me think of Zhao Zhou walking away from this old woman. He answered nothing. If you failed to do the right thing, talk was useless. Roshi Kaplow would so often just let things go, in the same spirit as this. If the student or the person was not ready to understand what he had to offer them, he recognized that. They're not ready. We don't explain. We don't deprive the person without insight, deprive them of their own experience through explanations. Roshi Kaplow used to say so often, never explain, never explain. I also think of his words in this encounter between Zhao Zhou and the old woman. He used to, twice at the most, he in private said to me, watch people when they don't know you're watching them. Watch their faces when they don't know you're watching. They're looking away. They're looking somewhere else. They're absorbed maybe in something. Watch them then, and you'll see much of their true face. Because, of course, we have, especially as we get older, we have developed these artifices where we can present ourselves, our faces in certain ways. But then when we drop our guard, there's something else that we reveal. I also think of Roshi Kaplow's words. Actually, these weren't his words. He was fond of them. Some Chinese master said, great as he was in what he said, he was greater still in what he left unsaid. Wu Man says, upon close examination, they both have their faults. It's yet another point of the koan. We have to always be careful about taking these things that Wu Man says too literally, because he will often, what he says is tongue-in-cheek. And just to be sensible about it, to say that the great Zhao Zhou, who would have been at least 80, 90, 100, 110 at this point, that he had his fault, you have to take that with a grain of salt. But hold on. There's no beginning to practice or end to enlightenment. There is no beginning to enlightenment or end to practice. These are the words of Zen Master Dogen. And Zhao Zhou, for all of the depth of his enlightenment, would surely have signed off on that statement. There's no end to understanding because there is no limit to mind. There's no limit to our capacity for wisdom. So how could there be any limit? It makes me question the whole concept of even the Buddha himself as having come to supreme perfect enlightenment. Perfect enlightenment? Perfect? Absolutely perfect? What could that mean? Great enlightenment, yes. I have no question about that. When you look at the words, the sutras, that was great enlightenment, but perfect? each one of us, you could say, every one of us without exception, is some admixture of understanding and blindness, of seeing and not seeing, some mixture of purity, wisdom, compassion, and the other side, greed, anger, and delusion. Kensho, that is a first seeing into one's true nature. Kensho, Roshi Kapo used to say, Kensho does not transform our personality and character. It establishes the basis for transforming our personality and character. As I've said so many, many times from this seat, after Kensho, there are still endless blind passions to uproot, habit forces, superficial and deeper, deeply ingrained tendencies to some gross or subtle form of greed, hostility, and delusion. There's a dialogue in one of Roshi's books, Zen Merging of East and West, where at a workshop, a participant of the workshop hears something, as I did, what I just said, and says to Roshi, "Hey, wait a minute, I thought Kensho cleared up our faults." And he says, Kensho points up our faults. Once we've seen into this exquisitely pure nature of ours, then our remaining defilements, our faults, our blind spots, are all the more painfully clear to us. We can't dodge them anymore. Not all of them, anyway. We can't pretend they're not there. This is one of the great values of an initial insight into one's true nature. It becomes the prod, the sand that enables an oyster to develop a pearl. It's painful to have seen the nature of things, one's own nature, everyone else's nature, and to continually find oneself pushed in this direction and that direction, as Roshi used to say it so often. Knowing the way that is straight ahead, and yet veering off that in one's reactions to people and things. Someone with a strong karmic affinity with the Dharma will not let this turn them away from practice. They will feel all the more compelled to keep sitting and sitting. And that's one of the most inspiring things that Roshi Kaplow always modeled, was daily sitting. I lived here at the center about 15 years, and there was hardly a single night, and of course I'm talking about when there was no formal sitting, there was hardly a single night that he didn't put in at least half an hour. Often with just one or two other people in the Zendo, sometimes alone. This is what you want to see. And someone of any stage, especially someone of an advanced stage, that they keep going back to the well to remove the dusts from the mind, to keep polishing and polishing and polishing. It shows tremendous aspiration. Like anyone, any teacher or student, Roshi Kaplow had his lingering attachments and blind spots. He would be the first to acknowledge that. And he had many different sides to him, like all of us. in the link building, we've posted a lot of photos of Philip Kaplow over the course of his life. I pulled out a couple of them to put on the altar here. We have a large one at the center, one of our favorites. This one was shot right after a seven-day sesshin, and he has that kind of blasted look on his face, almost intoxicated with the oneness of all beings, the perfection of all beings. He's in a kind of a bliss state. And then under it, I set a photo showing a different, very different face of Roshi Kaplow. Severe, demanding because he knew what was possible for every one of his students, what they had within them, the potential, this perfect Buddha nature. We also put up in the portico a bust, a little statue of the head of Roshi Kaplow. This has an amazing story behind it. One of our members, about 10 years ago maybe, just up and decided he wanted to do a sculpture of Roshi Kaplow's head, a bust, and on his own. And this is someone who had never done a sculpture before. He was not a sculptor. He just decided he wanted to do a sculpture. Working from one photo, he brought into us this clay, wet clay mold of the sculpture, to our astonishment, and said, "What do you think? How can I improve this?" And we could see problems with it, so we gave him a dozen other photos of Roshi Kaplow, and said, rang the bell and sent him out. And then a short while later, he brought back the bronzed sculpture that we see there in the portico. That's the little tiny room. It's sort of part of the link, not exactly, but sort of part of the link. He brought in the bronze sculpture and said it was starting to crack. The clay was starting to crack. I had to bronze it. So we didn't get a second pass at it. And the eyes are not right, and the mouth is not right. But the rest is amazingly true to Roshi Kaplow. So we set it there, we turn it to the side. The profile is him 100%, with that strong nose and chin. I keep it in my quarters. It's even though it's not perfect, it's good enough that it's nice having him there. We all have multiple aspects to ourselves, and even though you've seen the photos of Roshi Kaplow, you may see different things than now, than you did a year ago or 5 years ago. Photos have a way of changing because we change. The eyes with which we look at these photos now are not the same eyes with which we looked at them last time. That's what's so compelling about photos, what can be so compelling about them. We see them. We see new things in them as we age, as we acquire more life experience, as we have suffered more, as we've experienced joy more, and the richness of human beings. We see more in photos. We see more in living people. And finally, the verse. The question is the same each time. The answer, too, is the same. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. The question is the same each time. Okay, what is the way to Wu Tai Shan? What is the way to our true nature? The answer, too, is the same. Go straight on. Sand in the rice, thorns in the mud. Another thing Roshi Kapo used to say was, there are these two aspects to ourselves, these two sides that are really not different sides. They're integrated into each one of us. And from the point of view of ego, everything is ego. From the point of view of our true nature, there's only true nature. We could say that until full enlightenment, there is always some self-interest behind everything. People who think that they're so virtuous because they do good deeds are deluding themselves. There's no need to think of oneself as virtuous. There's a payoff. At the very least, there is the way in which we see ourselves as virtuous or as good people. That's the self-interest part. If you don't see it, then maybe you should look more closely. And yet, from the other side, looked at from the other side of the coin, it's all the functioning of our pure enlightened nature. There's only this enlightened. It's not our true nature and it's sort of mixed up, darkened with our egotism. It's just our true nature. As illogical as that sounds, there is only this enlightened nature for each one of us. So then, who is this old woman? Who is Joshu? Jaujo? Who am I? That's really the question that this koan is posing. I'm going to close with some words from Joseph Conrad, the novelist, and these apply to Roshi Kaplo and they apply to every one of us. It is when we seek to grapple with another person's most intimate need that we see how incomprehensible, wavering, and misty are the beings with whom we share the light of the stars and the warmth of the sun. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.